From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although she had just a brief career and made only a small number of films, Louise Brooks has endured over the years as one of the most provocative and well-known silent film icons. Now, on the centenary of her birth, Peter Cowie has paid tribute to the star and her tumultuous life in Louise Brooks' Lulu Forever. It's published by Rizzoli Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Cowie back to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
Didn't you have a relationship, I mean a friendship with Louise Brooks?
Yes, it was mostly epistolary. We met in 1970 and we became friends because I bought the obligatory pint of gin to her apartment. And when she saw that, she loosened up and she put some milk on the side and she worked her way through the afternoon. And then we began exchanging letters because I lived in London. And she wrote the most extraordinary letters, wonderful, wonderful letters. Really, really revealing of herself. They were captious, they were garrulous, they were bitchy, they were trenchant by turns. And sometimes you would get two a week, sometimes you get one a month, and sometimes there would be a silence after you'd made some faux pas. I remember I called her a call girl at one point because she practically invited the criticism and she didn't speak to me for a while. Then she came back and she said, actually, you're right, I practically was a call girl in the 40s.
Because that's how she had to survive after her career had gone down the tubes. We'll get to that later. This is before she wrote her memoir that called so much attention to her and revived her career, at least in the minds of an awful lot of film buffs.
Yes, and this was before Ken Tynan wrote his famous New Yorker piece that came out in I think early 79, and then her memoirs appeared from in 1982, Lulu in Hollywood. But I started in 1970, so most of the letters were through the 70s, and she wrote a series of articles which were published in Europe. I had a small magazine called Focus on Film, and I'm very proud that we published her final piece, which was called Why I Will Never Write My Memoirs.
Which I then did, of course. Now, how many films did she appear in?
About 25, if you really added up all the films where she has a fleeting appearance or where she was cast and shot and then cut out. But really, what it boils down to is probably two great films, Diary of a Lost Girl and Pandora's Box. One excellent film, or two excellent films, The Beggars of Life by William Wellman and Prix de Beauté by an Italian director. And then films after that where she had a very small part and scored, like The Show Off, for example, or It's the Old Army Game with W.C. Fields. She had a good comic sense, but she turned her back on Hollywood. She hated those kind of films. And I think it was only in the films in Germany that she really gave of her full self.
Had she wanted to be a movie star?
No, she wanted to be a dancer. She was obsessed with dancing, and Ted Shawn and Ruth St. Dennis brought her to New York, and she was in her teens, and she danced for Flo Ziegfeld, and she really wanted to do that as a profession. And indeed, when her Hollywood career finally petered out, she went back to a dancing school in the Midwest. And she moved with the skill of a dancer. In Pandora's Box and Diary of a Lost Girl, there are great moments where she suddenly explodes with kinetic energy, rushes across a set or up a staircase. She was a born dancer.
But she also looks like a modern actress sometimes in films where everybody else is working from older traditions. Is this because she was self-taught as an actress?
I think it's something to do with her look, Leonard. I think that if we opened this door and we let in all the silent actresses one by one, only Greta Garbo and Louise Brooks would look like one of us. I think that she has this sort of timeless look, and she was able to confront life head on. So in all the pictures in my book, it was only when it came out I suddenly realized this. She's never looking down. She's always looking out fearlessly. And Ado Kiroux, the surrealist French critic, said that Louise Brooks sees in every man a partner in orgasm. And I think that's what the message she's sending.
Yes, it was. There's a wink, sometimes a smirk. You write that most people are probably more familiar with her from photos than from her movies.
I think that's true.
And this image comes across in still photos in a way that is rare, isn't it?
It's very rare, and it's very fortunate that those photos exist from a time when Hollywood spent money on taking stills and hired great photographers, like Hurrell, for example, to take pictures of these stars. But the problem is that many people have never seen those silent films of Pabst's, and therefore she's paradoxically better known in Europe than she is over here.
Her look is so much a part of her legend. When did she start to wear her hair in the bob that she's so well known for?
Her mother sent her to have it done when she was about 11 or 12 years old. And when she got to Berlin at the age of 22 to shoot Pandora's Box, Pabst wanted to have a more curly style, but when he tried it out, he realized it didn't work. Now, after she came back and this silence had given place to sound and she got a few roles from Harry Cohn at Columbia, they changed her hairstyle and they made it much more orthodox. And the result is, in those films of the 30s, she looks like the girl next door. She hasn't got that special quality.
She was so beautiful and had a magical screen presence. So why do you think she never attained the stature of a Garbo or a Dietrich?
I think one of the reasons is she had no business sense. Don't forget, Garbo was very savvy in negotiating her contracts with MGM. Louise had absolutely no interest in material things. She lived for the day. Her idea of fun was to go out clubbing with some wealthy man who would give her fur coats and pick up the tab. And
she was rather sexually adventurous. Did that hurt her in Hollywood in the 20s?
I don't think so. In pre-code Hollywood, she once told me that she slept with between 6,000 and 8,000 men, but then Simenon claimed that he slept with 10,000 women, and I always think people are either drunk or they add a few zeros when they tell you that. But it's certainly possible that she reached 1,000, because she really was, she gave herself very freely to people.
And she had a brief affair with Charlie Chaplin, for example.
Indeed, a very rich one that lasted almost 2 months in the summer of 1925. And he sent her a handsome check at the end of it. And he's one of the few people who Louise never excoriated in print or even in gossip to me. She was really worshipped him.
She was molested when she was 9 years old growing up in Kansas. Is that one of the reasons she was so free sexually?
I think so. And I think it's one of the reasons that she was eventually almost consumed by that. Certainly when she corresponded with Pabst late in his life, she said that the whole part of Lulu had reminded her of Mr. Flowers, this notorious neighbor who had molested her. Although we never know exactly what happened, actually. The mother blamed her, as the mothers often do, but we don't really know. And Louise could embroider, you know. She could embellish things, as everyone does with age.
But being molested at 9, whether you... were complicitous or not, you're never complicitous.
No, that's right.
And you really do see somebody who understands all of those complexities in those two films that you made for Pabst. My guest is Peter Cowie, C-O-W-I-E. His latest book is Louise Brooks, Lulu Forever, published by Rizzoli, with lots of incredible photographs of this woman who may have been one of the most beautiful film stars ever. How did she make the transition from dance to movies?
She met Walter Wanger, who was then a young producer at Paramount in New York, and he said, you should go for a screen test. Well, in those days, up until 1927, Paramount shot all its films at the old Astoria Studios out on Long Island, and she loved New York. She never liked the West Coast, and so she went for this screen test, and as a result, she got some minor parts, and then she did marry her, the director of the W.C. Fields picture, it's the old army game, Eddie Sutherland. And he took her out to the Hollywood Hills, and they had a mansion with servants and dogs and pool, and she used to go up to San Simeon and have those riotous weekends that are immortalized in Citizen Kane. But she never really fitted in, and after less than 2 years, she just walked out and came back to New York.
And she said to you, no honest person can be a movie star.
Quite right. He said, no, it's a contradiction in terms for Louise. She felt that there was an artifice to being a movie star that she did not want to have anything to do with. And when she praised Pabst again in her later letters, she kept saying that he was the one person who showed her unvarnished. You know, there was no artifice about her acting there.
Well, when she went to Germany to work for Pabst, she was making the opposite trip from so many other actresses, Paula Negri, Greta Garbo, Marlene Dietrich. They all came to the United States to become big stars. Was this considered a good career move at the time?
No, I think it was something quite extraordinary, and she is the only example, I think, of a Hollywood personality going that way at that time. It was sheer chance, because Pabst wanted Marlene Dietrich for the part, but he found her too old already and probably too sophisticated. He wanted someone very young and innocent, and he'd seen photographs from Louise's performance in A Girl in Every Port, where she plays...
That's Howard Hawks?
Yeah, Howard Hawks, 1927, late 27, early 28. And he took a gamble, and, you know, it was a long trip in those days. Lindbergh then had just flown the Atlantic, so film cans couldn't be sent. He had to judge her on pictures, and it was a risk, and it came off.
And the film was considered scandalous at the time, wasn't it? As I understand it, the first portrayal of a lesbian in the movies, it's all about sexuality, and even though there's nothing explicit in it, it's quite clear that it's made for adults.
Yes, there's a strong erotic charge to it that I think reflects Berlin in that period. I mean, this was an extraordinary melting pot where you would meet at any one day Vladimir Nabokov, Horowitz, Brecht, Lotte Lenya, Christopher Isherwood. Everybody was there, and she could have run into those people any night.
But she said, my happiest time I ever had was when I was making pictures in Paris and didn't speak French. I was happy because I didn't have to talk to anyone or explain anything.
That's right.
So she was something of a loner as well.
Yes, she was. She didn't speak German at all. She loved reading, even at that stage, which explains why she became a great writer. She was already reading Schopenhauer on the set of Pandora's Box.
So then she stopped making films? For what reason? Because she just stopped getting decent parts?
No, I think the real crux of the matter was that she'd made a film called The Canary Murder Case for Paramount just before she left for Europe. And when she came back, sound had taken over, and Paramount wanted her to come out to the coast and to dub her lines, and she refused. So they put somebody else in to do it, and she lost her contract. And then, as I said earlier, she had to go on almost beg roles from Harry Cohn at Columbia, and she was pretty much on Skid Row. And it's very sad to see her in a picture like Overland Stage Raiders, her final one, where John Wayne is alongside her, and the trailer doesn't even feature Louise Brooks.
So she became an alcoholic, or she probably already had become an alcoholic.
Yes.
Then bankrupt. Didn't William Paley bail her out at one time?
He certainly did. They had a brief affair in 1928, and when she was really up against it, she went to his office and asked for his help, and he gave her $250 a month for the rest of her life on one proviso, that she would use it to research her career as a writer. And, of course, she didn't do that. She poured most of it, into the gin bottle. But nevertheless, she was sustained by that. And then she was discovered by someone we should never forget, James Card, who was the curator of film at George Eastman House. And he tracked her down under the old Queensboro Bridge in this walk-up apartment, and he persuaded her to come to Rochester. And he found her an apartment, and then he put her in the Dryden Theatre at Eastman House, and he said, I want you to see all these classics of the silent screen. And gradually, she saw all the films that in her frivolous youth she'd had no time to see.
And became an expert on film, started writing about films.
That's right.
And that's how people rediscovered her. Most Americans at the time probably had little knowledge of Louise Brooks. Now, there's even there are people who still wear the Louise Brooks cut, the haircut. They try to look like her today.
Well, I think you've put your finger on another aspect of her enduring appeal, and that is the fashion icon element. You know, whether it's Anna Wintour or Mary Quant, who invented the miniskirt, so many people have aped that look. And even there's a perfume issued by Cacharel in Paris called Lulu, and Jean-Paul Gaultier had a fashion show from Lulu to Easy Rider. She is an icon, and she remains so. If you look up style.com, you'll always find her on it, whereas many other silent stars are not featured there.
Can we see her influence in films today?
Perhaps in the way she acts, in the way the restraint in which she acts, she reminds me of a woman like Meryl Streep, for example. The way that she will use her upper lip to register emotion or a glance. She is not waving her arms around. She was very economical, and I think that is now an acting style which is very preferred.
Peter Cowie's latest book is Louise Brooks, Lulu Forever, in a gorgeous edition from Rizzoli, full of wonderful photographs, both the publicity photographs and stills from the various movies that Louise Brooks appeared in. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.